In honor of Military Appreciation Month, Verizon thought of a lot of different ways we could show our appreciation, like rolling out the red carpet, giving you your own personal marching band, or throwing a bumping shindig. At Verizon, we're doing all that in the form of special military offers. That's why, this month only, we're giving military and veteran families a $200 Verizon gift card and a phone on us, with a select trade-in and a new line on select unlimited plans. Think of it as our way of flying a squadron of jets overhead while launching fireworks. Now that's what we call a celebration, because we're proud to serve you. Visit your local Verizon store to learn more. $200 Verizon gift card requires smartphone purchase, $799.99 or more with new line on eligible plan. Gift card sent within 8 weeks after receipt of claim. Phone offer requires $799.99 purchase with new smartphone line on Unlimited Ultimate or Postpaid Unlimited Plus. Minimum plan $80 a month with autopay plus taxes and fees for 36 months. Less $800 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. 0% APR. Trade-in must be from Apple, Google, or Samsung. Trade-in and additional terms apply. In honor of Military Appreciation Month, Verizon thought of a lot of different ways we could show our appreciation, like rolling out the red carpet, giving you your own personal marching band, or throwing a bumping shindig. At Verizon, we're doing all that in the form of special military offers. That's why, this month only, we're giving military and veteran families a $200 Verizon gift card and a phone on us, with a select trade-in and a new line on select unlimited plans. Think of it as our way of flying a squadron of jets overhead while launching fireworks. Now that's what we call a celebration, because we're proud to serve you. Visit your local Verizon store to learn more. $200 Verizon gift card requires smartphone purchase, $799.99 or more with new line on eligible plan. Gift card sent within 8 weeks after receipt of claim. Phone offer requires $799.99 purchase with new smartphone line on Unlimited Ultimate or Postpaid Unlimited Plus. Minimum plan $80 a month with autopay plus taxes and fees for 36 months. Less $800 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. 0% APR. Trade-in must be from Apple, Google, or Samsung. Trade-in and additional terms apply.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic or Rockfin, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate your support. We know you have a million choices out there. Thank you for spending time with us. And if you like the show, please share it with your friends and family. It's the only way that the word's going to get out. We could not do this show without the amazing support of our sponsors. My Patriot Supply has been nice enough to create our own little website for us. It's preparewithmacroaggressions.com. You can go through that website and access everything that My Patriot Supply has for sale. They have emergency survival food. They have survival items, water filtration, air purification. My God, if you live through 2020, and you aren't thinking about getting prepared, you need to have your head examined. So take a look, go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com, and that'll get you to My Patriot Supply. They've been a supporter of the show for the last couple of months. We certainly do appreciate it. It allows us to do the things that we need to do and talk to the people that we want to talk to. So thank you to them. And speaking of people that we want to talk to, I have been, I've been a fan of Dean Henderson for a while, since I heard you on Richie Allen. And then I would go on Richie Allen and I would always be like a couple days behind you. And every time you went, I remember listening to it. So author Dean Henderson is here. Dean, nice to meet you virtually. I've been a fan of your work for a long time. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh man, thanks a lot, Charlie. I really appreciate you having me. And cool.
You sent me your book, Big Oil and Their Bankers in the Persian Gulf. And, you know, these days, I know that the media is lying to us. I understand they're making up narratives. They're kicking off false wars. But back when the first Gulf War started in 90, you know, the run up to it in 90 and the actual war starting in 91, I was a freshman in college. So I did not know what I did not know at that point. So now when I'm looking back on things, I see the agendas clearly here, you know, and the from 9/11 on, I can see them. It's pretty obvious. But I was not paying attention back then. I was watching CNN as Bernard Shaw was hiding under the bed when the rockets were coming in, and everyone was switching the helmets when the sirens were but so I know that I was being lied to, based on just experience with these people, but I don't know the depths of what the lie was. Fill me in on how that war, how that, whatever it was, I don't know if it was a war, it seemed kind of one-sided, but how that thing kicked off, what was real, what was actually happening in Kuwait, and what was just media manipulation in order to get us to accept this?
Yeah, well, that was the whole, you know, April Glaspie letter that they sent, you know, to Saddam, telling him that they weren't gonna, you know, basically indicating they weren't gonna respond if he invaded Kuwait. And so he invaded Kuwait, but actually what happened was Kuwait had already invaded Iraq because they were using Santa Fe Drilling, which was a CIA oil drilling, horizontal drilling company. Because if you horizontal drill, you know, you can go under a border. Mm-hmm. And so it's this, you know, good old oil companies at work with the CIA. And Santa Fe Drilling was horizontally drilling into South Ramallah in Iraq, one of the biggest oil fields on earth. And so, you know, Saddam said, all right, then. And he just basically pushed the troops back and it wasn't really much. It was done. And then there was, of course, all the babies on incubators, which, you know, girls on incubators, which turned out to be a total fabrication by, I don't remember which PR firm was hired by. There it is. Hill & Knowlton, a good one. And so it's all manufactured. And then, of course, we did invade Iraq. It wasn't much of an invasion. It was more of a, maybe the first real use, although it was used some in Vietnam, of electromagnetic weaponry, where they sort of beamed this message to these Iraqi troops, millions, you know, everybody was nervous. It was going to be this, we were, a lot of people here. I mean, I was in grad school and I remember thinking, man, this isn't going to be a pushover. You know, this is going to be a real battle here. That's a lot of troops Iraq's got, and they're battle hardened against Iran and all this stuff. And yeah, it should have been. And then to everyone's amazement, these troops just kind of gave up and laid down, and some were just obliterated and they couldn't find the bodies. And apparently they were using this voice-to-skull technology, which is the precursor to 5G, and beaming these people a message that said, Allah wants you to surrender, and is the best research I've come across. And yeah, it was something weird. Everybody knew it was something weird that was going on there. So this begins the kind of mainstream maybe rollout, although they did use this in Vietnam along the DMZ actually too, to do some things and do some weather things too in Vietnam. But yeah, it was all just a fabrication. And then of course, you know, what happens, Iraq at that time had taken a left turn under Saddam, who had traditionally been working for the CIA. He helped assassinate El Karim Qasim, president, before him, for the CIA. His handler was Bruce Odell of the CIA. I even have that in my book. And clearly he was a right-wing kind of fascist nut job. He was going after the Shia. He was going after the Communist Party. All of a sudden, the Iraqi people sort of weighed in, and he had become a member of this American-Iraqi Business Forum, I think it was called. Henry Kissinger was the head of it, and it was all the big corporations, AT&T, ExxonMobil, you name it. And they were privatizing the Iraqi economy. They're trying to. Saddam took a left turn and actually began to side with his people. He got out of that form and he became more of a nationalist. And just like Noriega, or just like any other dictator that we've used and then dropped over the side when they went the other way. And that's what happened. And so people don't understand that before the war in Iraq in 1990, there was actually state-owned farms and collective farms and, warehouses where like all the communal potatoes were stored or the communal wheat or whatever for the year. I mean, it was a very socialist communist economy. It had been for quite some time. And Saddam was trying to change that. The people didn't allow it to happen, basically, and like they never have in Iraq. I mean, one thing you have to understand about Iraq is that the tradition of communism is deep, and it goes back to the mid-50s. When they got rid of the king and nationalized for the first time ever, they were the first country in the world to ever nationalize one of the crown's oil companies, their tentacles. And it was before that, it was the Iraqi Petroleum Institute. And after that, they nationalized the oil company and it stayed on to, till the point of the war. And actually, it still is, but it's heavily contracted now. But there still is that tradition where they wouldn't let go of that, just like Pemex in Mexico, same thing, which is what we should do in this country with ExxonMobil and Chevron, nationalize them, and just, then we can steer our energy policy where we want it to go, into renewables, and wherever else, and away from, this war-driven oil economy, because it's all in the Middle East. But anyway, so that was all just, and then, of course, in the ensuing, I think, two quarters, big oil's profits were up like 600% on average, because they were suddenly supplying oil to not just, the Americans, but to the Iraqis as well, through contracts. Again, they would produce the oil, but we would ship it, or we would, it would be our tanker, ExxonMobil's tankers or storage facilities or whatever it is. And then selling guns to both sides. So the defense contractors, of course, had a huge boom during that time. And we basically, Iraq was really important because it was a socialist, successful Middle Eastern country. That was an example we could not have. Just like Yugoslavia was an example we could not have. Serbia was an example we could not have. Well, really Yugoslavia before that, in Europe, and ever since Tito. And so they were also successful. They were socialist. They were in, both of these countries were involved in Comecon, which was this thing where you barter things. So the Yugoslavs would barter their, their Yugo cars for these Iraqi tractors that were pretty hot shit, And and that was really circumventing the corporate globalist control of the planet. And they didn't like that. So they had to go after Yugoslavia. They had to go after Iraq. They had to go after Syria for the same reason, and still are going after Syria. They had to go after Libya, of course. And because Gaddafi was way beyond all this stuff, it was an anarcho-syndicalist and was leading this whole kind of global South effort, against the cartels and the banks. And so they did a lot in the Middle East, obviously. Where'd it come from? Well, the war on terror, which was the pretext to do all this. And now the war on terror has turned into a war on just humanity, with this COVID-19 operation. And this is an operation. It's covert identification 2019. We're going to identify everybody. We're going to get inside you. We're going to now just take your whole body and just atomize and objectify and break it down and put it under a microscope and know everything about you, just like they've done with the natural world over the last 8,000 years. These Nephilim, which we'll get into, I'm sure. Yep. But that's what's going on. And so the war phase, I think, like in the Middle East, we've pretty much conquered the Middle East. We've knuckled under, not we, but the crown. We've knuckled under you know, countries like Egypt. We've got countries like Sudan, which we just sponsored a coup in to get rid of al-Bashir because he was one of the people that didn't allow a private central bank in his country. So there was no Rothschild central bank in Sudan. That's one that people don't know. They know Cuba, they know Iran, but Sudan was a real kind of rural country. That's why they set up the whole Darfur, the fake Darfur massacres and the fake refugee crisis and everything, because they were going after Bashir. Well, they finally got rid of him. So now the Sudanese have signed an Israeli peace deal along with the Egyptians, along with the UAE, along with everyone thinks probably next will be the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and everybody. And so they're coming out of the closet, really, is all it is. They're admitting this relationship they've had for years, because you have to understand that the crown is also in the Middle East, and that's the House of Saud and in Kuwait, the House of al-Sabah, and in Oman and in Bahrain and in United Arab Emirates. These are all kingdoms, these are all monarchies that are part of the crown, you know, not just, you know, but they're there to do the bidding of the City of London, basically, and they send all their revenues to the City of London, all their profits, and they own Western corporations now, these sheikhs. They own a lot of the world economy. They own a lot, big chunk of Citibank, actually.
Yep.
You know, the sheikhs do in the Middle East. And so they've intertwined these. It's a global thing. I always say, and I've said it from the beginning of my blog, it's a global oligarchy. That's what I still think that best describes what we're dealing with, a global oligarchy. And then if you want to get into the bloodlines and whether or not these things are human, then you can go there. But even if you aren't comfortable going there, fine. Just understand that this is a global oligarchy of these tight-knit families that work together, and that there's really no nation state anymore with the power to stand up to this thing, and that their base is in the City of London geopolitically, and that their wealth repository is Switzerland. And specifically the Bank of International Settlements, run by kind of the Hohenzollern crown family, runs that. They all have little tasks, the crown families. You'll find it's interesting. But Queen Elizabeth plays the harp. So she runs harp. And if you look at their logo, there's a harp on it. And she's in charge of the mind control harp program, along with there's one other family involved with them. And I'm trying to remember, Aldobrandini's, I believe, which is the Italian black nobility from the old Holy Roman Empire days. And the Aldobrandinis, for example, marry into the Rothschilds and, you know, they intermarry. And so, you know, people say, how many families is there? Well, you know, some people do say 13. Fritz Springmeier said 13. Gary Wayne said 13, you know, but I tend to think it's a loose number. And if anything, the actual bloodlines are probably smaller than 13 now, because they're so interbred. The Habsburgs, the Bourbons, the Merovingians, the Vichys, the Rallas, the Anjous, these Plantagenets, the Collins, the Sinclairs, they've interbred to the point where really the blood is, it is one big happy family, and they're inbred. And that's why they talk about the Habsburg chin, you know, where it's like a crooked chin. There's actually people, it's a common thing. They talk about this Habsburg chin because they're all inbred. Harry kind of has it because his daddy's a Habsburg. Actually, right. Prince Harry, but you know, it's his dad's King Juan Carlos of Spain, not Prince Charles. That's pretty much widely known in the European, circles. But I don't know the number, but you know, 13 is possible. And I think what I'm seeing right now with the COVID is interesting, is the shift to the East and sort of the Khan family's picking up the slack here, with the Aga Khan Foundation, training all the Islamists for British intelligence. The Khan family, every president of India has descended from that bloodline. The current Pakistani president is a Khan. He can be seen in pictures with Lord Mountbatten and hanging out in the City of London. And the Li family has a bigger role now, the Chinese Li Red Dragon family, and the Yamamoto family is coming back into play. And the Singh family, which the Sikhs are a part of. And, if you notice the Shah family, the Shah of Iran, and that's a whole other dynasty. And King Zahir Shah of Afghanistan. Remember when we first went into Afghanistan, the first thing we did was reestablish the Loya Jirga, which was the monarchy, you know, pretty interesting, before anything else. And so they were back into the drug trade, which the crown controls, you know. and all the wealthy families in Afghanistan, the oligarchs, they run the opium trade for sure through Turkey with the Grey Wolves Mafia and into Europe and, you know, whatever else. And the Chinese, you know, going the other way. It's the triads who are, you know, pretty much a subsidiary of the Freemasons and also working for this crown. And but what you see, what you're seeing is a little bit of, to me, a shift to the east, like the crown internally. There's something going on where the Asian component of the crown is going to be more preeminent or more active. And that makes sense because geopolitically, you know, the crown and the city of London, to me, are leaning to China. And they actually are have sort of invented China. I mean, China is just this thing that, you know, there was a Maoist revolution and there was a cultural revolution. And then as soon as Deng Xiaoping came in there, Mao himself called him a capitalist rotor. He said he's going to sell you out. Sure enough, in 1973, he signs a detente with Kissinger, with the globalists. Part of the deal is one child, one male. We need them in the factories, kill the females, leave them at the markets, you know, which brutal policy, this one-child policy that I think Kissinger was influential in because he's a huge depopulation guy. And it happened right then. So, and anyway, meanwhile, Taiwan, yeah, they did steal all the gold. And Chiang Kai-shek was working with the CIA and the Crown, too. So he was a bad guy. Mao, I'm not sure. Some people say, you know, connect him with the bad guys. I don't know. His wife, I think, with doing the Cultural Revolution was where it got really crazy. And that's what they do a lot of times. They'll sponsor like a, like they did in Afghanistan, you know, when they went after Takiri, the leftist president of Afghanistan. And they put this CIA guy, Deep Mole, into his government. And they did this kind of radical land reform where they were seizing property of people, not compensating them, you know, just being crazy and go over the top. See, and this guy turns out, yeah, he was CIA, and Brezhnev is the guy that identified him as CIA. And that's when the Soviets came in. They realized that there was a coup going against the socialist government of Afghanistan, which was what that was. Again, same thing. And, you know, and so it's all about counter-revolution. They can't have revolution. The crown is their model of economics is a medieval model, Middle Ages. They love that kind of stuff. And I think what they're working on now is what I call electronic feudalism, where it's going back to feudalism, but now you're going to be sitting in a relatively comfortable but very small apartment with a lot of devices, and you're going to be competing with people all around the world, not just in China and Haiti now, but everywhere, to be the fastest Bitcoin miner or to be the fastest programmer for Amazon, writing code for, Google or, you know, and it's going to be like that. And they're just going to go to tokens, and it's going to go to electronic currency, and it's going to, the currency, what we know of as currency is going to be different. And digital, probably, of course, in the end. And that, yeah, I mean, if they can pull this off, it's always in history been, you know, with this crown, when they get the technology, you know, this has happened before. And when they get the high technology, that's when bad things have happened. And like the golden age, turns out it wasn't so golden, you know, and there, you know, and then the flood came. And I mean, and that was the technology. It was whatever they used to build the pyramids, whatever they used to build Machu Picchu, whatever that was, that enslaved humanity. That taught the Aztecs to do blood sacrifice because they didn't do it before that. See, that's the thing. They weren't naturally like that. And that's one of the biggest real society lies, you know, is that somehow the Indians, they were such savages. They actually weren't. And, you know, the British crown and the Spanish crown and the French taught them to.
Yeah. We're savages.
Yeah. And Kit Carson, they paid him per scalp to, you know, and so they were, nobody was scalping anybody until the crown came along, and they did it because they wanted to, you know, count the scalps and see how many Indians. And that was the way they did it. Sometimes they cut off a hand or something, you know, maybe. But, and then, you know, yeah, later when the Indians were pissed off, I suppose they scalped a few, you know, settlers, but they didn't, this was all foreign to them. They were like, what are these things? You know, they call them, Apache called them Weticos, and the Lakota here where I'm from, they call them Witkos, you know, which means crazy, you know, Tishonka Witko is crazy horse, you know, and, but they didn't mean crazy, like in a good way, you know, right. These guys. And, well, the Cree up in northern Canada called them Wendigos, and the Muslim called them Jinn, and the Sumerians called them Anunnakis, and the Egyptians called them Pharaohs, and Jesus called them the Holy Roman Empire that killed him. And, you know, it's just been this progression into the city of London of these, whatever these are. And 8,000 years is my timeline that I have that this has occurred. But yeah, I think we're nearing the end of the oil age now, and we're going to be moving into this, electronic communication, 5G, fourth industrial revolution. And that's where the money's at right now. That's where the, you know, big data, which is epitomized by Serco, the company. Everyone should just go to their website, look at their historical timeline. It's a little movie you can watch. It's pretty enlightening. And this is a crown company, but they're very powerful, and there's other companies contracting. It's all become, when they privatized everything ever since Reagan, they've been able to bring in these contractors into government, you know, and even into our military, to where we privatized our military with Blackwater and things like this. And that's all kind of a British feudalist mercantilist model of the East India Company, you know, where you set up a middleman and, you know, they would buy spice and just be the middleman and move back and forth and, you know, pay very little and sell very high. And that's what we're seeing now with the contracting of everything, the privatization of everything. This is not some, as some in the alt-right would argue, you know, this is not some great giant socialist conspiracy. They're trying to make it look like that because it's a marketing thing, and they have to sell us on this idea that we're all in this together and it's a collectivist thing. And, but you know, if you look around you, what's really happening, it's just the opposite. You're seeing the 1% increasing their wealth, increasing their concentration of wealth. Most people falling through the cracks, middle class going away, becoming the US economy, becoming more like a Bangladeshi economy, probably. In the long run, and then God forbid what happens to Bangladesh. I mean, people are probably just going to be starved out and, you know, deliberately vaccinated and killed, I suppose. That's what they've done. And then the vaccination, of course, is a big part of this. And I think it plugs in somehow, turns us into kind of antennas for the 5G. And it really does take you into the cloud in a way. And it really does. It's a transhumanist movement, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah. You were talking about the end of oil, and I saw something a couple of months ago that made me think of you when I saw it on the news, and now I've got you here, so I want to get your opinion on this. What was the purpose behind taking Aramco public now, out of all times? Was this a move made out of desperation by Saudi Arabia? Was this, were they trying to just cash in one last time before the oil paradigm changes, or what are we to make of the taking this public, and what was I guess at the time the biggest
they did
public,
take it
transition
public,
into a public company,
and they and they did take it public, right? I thought so,
in Riyadh they did for $2 trillion.
Well, there you go. I think you just answered your own question. $2 trillion, you know. But and that was a weird deal because everybody said it was this state-owned oil company. But see, when I did my master's thesis, which was about, you know, big oil, and that's what turned into big oil and their bankers, that began as a 144-page master's thesis, and the whole thesis is in that book. It's just chopped up in different chapters, you know, and in between there's stuff about, you know, stuff I learned later. But, you know, what I found out was as of, it would have been 89 is when it, you know, started, maybe 91 at the latest, was that Aramco was not publicly held, was not owned by Saudi Arabia. The shareholder, one of the biggest shareholders was Exxon Overseas Limited. You know, it's 28.33%, and I can only assume that probably the other three oil companies, the giants, the four horsemen, as I call them, which is Royal Dutch Shell, BP, Amoco, Chevron, Texaco, ExxonMobil, probably had a share, because that's always been the history in Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's when SoCal first found oil in Saudi Arabia in the 30s. That was Chevron, SoCal, Southern, you know, Southern California, whatever. Standard Oil of California. And when they found that, they instantly cut in those guys, those other friends of theirs, and it was private for years. And then they said, oh, we've nationalized it. But yet, like I said, even after the date, they said in their Aramco glossy brochure that they nationalized it. I found that it was still owned by ExxonMobil Overseas Limited. So I, you know, hard to say. Regardless, all the contracts, again, for shipping, for marketing, for refining, for chemical, you know, Saudi Arabia is just loaded with chemical plants. I mean, so like Royal Dutch Shell Plastics Polymers Division, you know. And then that's the kind, that's where they really cash in, is in the downstream market of the oil anyway, you know, and that's where the big money's at anyway. And that includes things like, you know, aviation, you know, I mean, so there's automobiles, obviously. So everything really does come from oil up to now. And that's what's changing with this fourth industrial revolution. But I just think, yeah, it was a lot of money. $2 trillion. That's a lot of money. And, officially, now it's okay. If it was in some way nationalized, now it's not again. Now it's back in the private sector, which is, you know, again, that's where these medieval crown people want to be. They don't want anything public, really. They'd rather have you paying to go to the library pretty soon and, you know, get on national park trails, or which you're already doing, national forest trails, even, and now in a lot of states, you know, not here, but. In the West Coast, I hear, you know, like, yeah, in Washington, Oregon, California, you got to pay to hike. I mean, it's not, there's nothing public. There's nothing public anymore. So it makes perfect sense that they would reprivatize Aramco if indeed it was, you know, at least at some level controlled by the Saudis. And I think that was just part of, you know, MBS and Trump kind of hit it off. And, you know, that was part of it too. I think Trump probably talked him into it. Because it'll be the, you know who it'll be. It'll be the Rothschilds and the same, you know, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley that bought those shares, that, you know, control them. Like they control everything on Wall Street. There's five companies that are interesting: BlackRock, Blackstone, Fidelity, which is FMR also, and Vanguard, and State Street, First Boston. And these are companies that still, you know, if you look at the Fortune 500, they're the top. In the top 10, usually in the top 5 or 6 shareholders of every company. Bank of New York Mellon's another one. But these are like bank holding companies of bank holding companies. And I still haven't got to the bottom of who actually controls these five companies. And they control Citibank and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and everything else too. But these were what I think, I don't know how you'd even prove it. You can't prove it right now because the Bank of England sits on these accounts for every offshore haven. And I'm pretty convinced anyway that these companies are the crown. This is the crown's money. This is how they really control the whole American economy. Big oil, big bank, big pharma, big everything, just to these five shell companies. And interestingly, like State Street, First Boston, that's the old Boston Brahmin, you know, Sutherland's, the Forbes, the, you know, the people that were running the East India Company and running the slave trade and bringing the opium in to the East Coast, the Perkins family. So yeah, I think there's, and yeah, you find out like Biden's, one of his great, great grandfathers was, worked for the East India Company and stuff like that. It gets pretty interesting. So yeah, it is about bloodlines. There's something about Biden they like right now. And I think it's just cause they'll go along with whatever in the techs, and you know, big tech is behind this guy. They wanted Trump for a while, which is why they put him in there. You know, Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, I do believe that the crown was behind him. They were totally spying on him, monitoring, but they backed him and rigged that election for Trump. And then now they rigged this election for Biden because they want to build back better. I mean, that slogan that he uses comes from World Economic Forum, and which, by the way, is run by Lord Mark Malik Brown is the vice chair. Everybody talks about Klaus Schwab, but Lord Mark Malik Brown, much more interesting guy. He's on the Queen's Privy Council, and he's also sitting on the board of Dominion Voting Machines, Smartmatic, Diebold, and he also started the Open Society Foundation of George Soros, has been running for years. He started it, and then Soros took over. Now he's going back to head it again, and he was, you know, he's really Yeah, but that just shows you who's running the show. So all this World Economic Forum, Bilderbergers, Trilateral Commission, whatever it is, Council on Foreign Relations, it all, these are all fronts for the Crown in the City of London. And that's where all the big money goes into. It just goes into the City of London. It goes into the offshore banking network. There's hundreds of trillions of dollars that if nation states could actually get a hold of and tax, at least we'd all be solvent. We'd all be, this country would be $27 trillion paid off. I mean, seriously, there's so much money. And that all started with the euro dollar and in the 60s, you know, and they started, you know, up until I think it was Reagan, you couldn't even, like a corporation couldn't take money out of the U.S. unless it was to buy goods or to facilitate the selling of goods. And then they had to repatriate it. Well, the euro dollar changed that. And that was just, that put the City of London back on kind of, yeah, British mercantilist mode, East India Company mode, to where all this oil money, all this drug money, all this trafficking money, all this whatever money just dumps into the City of London. There's no transparency. There's no regulation. No. Totally opaque. You don't know what's what. And it just goes into the offshore networks under numbered accounts that only the Bank of England knows, but which I suspect these five companies are very much involved with getting it at least over there. And it disappears down the offshore toilet, and there's no productivity coming from that money anymore. No. There's nothing of value that's added to the economy anymore. The IMF is a partner in that thing because they'll loan a country a bunch of money. They'll give half of that money to some corrupt official, and he'll repatriate it to the City of London and to the offshore network. Then the IMF will privatize things in that country and do absolutely nothing to help the people, but then bill the country for the debt, the so-called debt.
This is what got me going down this rabbit hole back in 2007. Was John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he laid out the plan, the IMF and the World Bank coming in and extending credit to these countries that can't afford it, to build a hydroelectric power plant that doesn't ever pencil out like it was never going to. And then when they fall behind on their payments, they come in and extract something from them, an agreement to privatize their lumber industry or fishing industry or build a U.S. military base or vote their way in a U.N. resolution or some shitty deal that they didn't want, but they get muscled into this. And I saw I've watched this documentary twice, actually, called The Spider's Web. You might have heard of it.
Yeah, I saw
about the City of London and the bank and the offshore banking. And they make the case that the overrule of the British Empire went away back in the 50s or 60s, and that the more covert means, it went underground and became this network of, you know, Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Guernsey, Jersey, you know, all these offshore banking havens that the British set up. And though their fingerprints are still, you know, all over the offshore banking, they give the appearance that they're not still colonizing the world, yet they are in a more covert way through their financial systems.
Right, exactly. It's just a more sophisticated version of British Empire, but it's still there. It never went away. It's, you know, the Commonwealth certainly plays a big role in it as well. When the Queen has the ability to basically get rid of, you know, an Australian prime minister, which she did in 1975 with Gough Whitlam, who was trying to set up a minerals, kind of a producer cartel to go up against, you know, Reynolds Aluminum and Alcoa and, you know, Xstrata. Well, that wasn't in there at that time. That's a new, relatively new Crown tentacle, but Glencore, you know, whoever these, Rio Tinto. Trying to go up against those guys and get a fair price for, you know, because Australia has a lot of minerals. I mean, it's like, you know,
China's or noticed. Coast,
depending on how you look at it, with a lot of minerals. So she actually, appointed a new governor general, John Kerr, and got rid of the governor general even, and then got rid of Whitlam. And I mean, it was that's the power of the Crown right there. Yeah. And You know, so it's so funny how and then they'll try to tell us, you know, these are just figureheads. Right. Well, you know, when you can overthrow a government of Australia just with a signing of a piece of paper, I guess, I mean, that's not, you know, that means you actually have quite a bit of power. So it's a joke. And it's the same with the money. You can't know how much they own. So people think, whatever, Sam Walton's or his kids are the richest, or, you know, Bill Gates or whoever. But in fact, these people, no, they're far, I believe, wealthier than, and Gates to me, and like Elon Musk and these guys, they're basically crown agents, kind of like Rockefeller was. You know, he was a gopher for the Rothschilds, really. And these guys are gophers for the Rothschilds, or now I would call it the crown, because I think that's a more apt term for it. But yeah, no, they're just doing the bidding. And that's, you know, Knight Commander of the British Empire, Bill Gates, you know, and Royal Society member, Elon Musk. And so there you have it. So, and if you look at the fingerprints of COVID, it's all about the Purbright Institute, and it's all about Burroughs Wellcome Trust, which these crown charities, which, you know, operate Wuhan, operate all over the world with these things. It's all about General Electric. It's all about the smart meters, which are essential to the smart grid that they're setting up. It's all, you know, which is a crown agent company, which Serco came out of. Serco and GE, I'm sorry, that's not right. Serco and GE came out of RCA, right? And so then RCA had developed sonar, been involved with the Kennedy hit, really close, actually, with David Sarnoff was the head of it at that time, and they provided cover for FBI Division 5 agents who were under cover for British intelligence, like Guy Bannister, and they did the hit. It was Sir William Stephenson that orchestrated the Kennedy assassination out of Jamaica, Tyndall compound, because Jamaica still has a very British crown sort of contingent, we'll say. But it's all about Crown Castle, which put up almost all the cell towers here and in England and many places. And Berkshire Hathaway helped them get into the U.S. So Warren Buffett is somewhere complicit in this. And they have changed their name to Akiba now, but they're on Fleet Street in the City of London. That's their headquarters. They're a Crown Agent Corporation. Lockheed Martin, British Aerospace, building the space fence and ionizing space, Crown Agent Corporations. As far as Big Pharma, you have GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, and you have AstraZeneca. Moderna is a virtual mirror of AstraZeneca, so it's also a crown control company. And as far as the board members, GSK also owns a big chunk of Pfizer, it turns out. So it's, you know, they're going to clean up. The crown's going to clean up off of this vaccination. They're going to put their companies in a better position, because they've all gone online already, and they're pushing everything online, and they're going to knock out the competition of the middle class of the United States and Europe, the entrepreneur class, make them dependent on them, kind of like they've done with the lower class, and kind of like, you know, and they don't mind that. They need an underclass, and they don't really care about a middle class. The British have always been very careful to knock down the competition. So they did it to Germany. I mean, way before Hitler, they did hyperinflation, and, you know, Germany was coming up with some really good technology, Mercedes-Benz, you know, stuff like that. I mean, they're good engineers, the Germans, and that freaked out the British Empire. So the Anglos were like, no, we got to take them down a notch. So they created the hyperinflation. They actually had relations with Hitler, where he came to the Tavistock Institute at somewhere in the 19 teens. And Tavistock is a crown control thing in the City of London, Chatham House. It's their mind control operations center. And it's where they steer cultures, like American music culture.
Yeah, I've always called it the culture factory, because that's where they create the trends and promote all that stuff. And you know, I was in London like 18 months ago, and I did one of those double-decker bus touristy type things where you get up on the top and you go through. And I was kind of half paying attention. But I, I got the feeling I knew when we had entered the city of London. And for those that are unaware, there's London itself, and then there's what is known as the City of London, which is like a 1 square mile city within the city that's kind of like a Washington, D.C., or kind of like a Vatican. It's sort of in and of itself. And I could tell when we got there because the artwork and the statues were very much concerned with reptilians and dragons. And it seemed to be, I got the feeling that the dragons were protecting the gold. And I remember popping up and going to my wife, we must be inside the City of London. She's got the little headphones on. She goes, yeah, we are. How'd you know? And I said, there's dragons everywhere. And she goes, what does that mean? I go, I don't know. But somehow I have to ask Dean Henderson what that means.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've seen the pictures of those. And it is interesting. I mean, they have the whole Freemason thing, you know, where every bank in the city has its own lodge, and the Lord Mayor has his own lodge, and you know, and then you have this thing where you know, in Freemasonry, where you know Lucifer is their you know, they like Lucifer. They think he's a light bearer. That's just what they believe. And Lucifer is a fallen angel, and fallen angels are the Nephilim. And it just seems to me that, what's up with all the symbolism about dragons, and what's up with, there's so many things, and it's everywhere. It's all over the world. Anywhere you find monarchy, you know, you'll see the same thing in Thailand. You know, when you're looking at the king or queen, you know, the king's castle or, you know, home or whatever it is, temple, you know, whatever. And look at the AMA and the logo of the American Medical Association and the snake, you know, and that was, of course, Rockefeller's invention that bumped aside naturopathy and homeopathy and replaced it with allopathic medicine, drugs, and cut people up, do surgery, give them drugs, you know, and as far as their holistic health, forget about it. No money in that. And so there's so much to that, and I'm by no means, you know, an expert, but what I do believe is that it does go back to Sumeria, at least, and the Anunnaki, the Nephilim, you know, according to the Sumerian clay tablets, which we at least have a history of, you know, we at least have that written down, and for years people didn't take it seriously. They were like, that's crazy. They do that, you know, like if you're black or brown, your myths are just kind of crazy and they're just myths and they're just stories. But if you're white, it's, by God, it's the Bible, you know.
Right.
It's the Bible. Literally, it's the Bible. Right. So, which of course isn't, you know, it's all the same. But anyway, they say, you know, they were enslaved into agriculture by these Anunnaki. They came here, they did DNA experiments. They needed gold to patch up their, you know, their atmosphere, you know, the ozone on their planet. And it was at the same time when the mines started appearing in South Africa and the Michael Tellinger's little circle things that he talks about. And it was at the same. And then shortly after that, you had the thing, you know, Machu Picchu, and you had Angkor Wat, you had all these huge, you know, stone things that indicate, you know, worshiping the gods, pointing towards heaven. And instead of, you know, before that it was animism, and we knew we were from here. We didn't look to the heavens for the answers. We looked right here for the answers. Right. We're from here. But then here comes these aliens, these Nephilim, and they're telling us, no, you're from heaven. You're from there. You're from outer space. You're from, and then maybe we are if we were DNA experimented on partly even, you know, and so there's that. And who knows who was and who wasn't. I think there's both, somewhere. And I think the ones that were can still unclog the pineal gland, you know, and decalcify it and be just fine. But there was something going on. And, you know, from there, you know, after pretty much enslaving mankind into agriculture in Mesopotamia, you know, which is Sumeria, then they proceeded to Babylon, they proceeded to Egypt, built the pyramids, developed the mystery schools, which Freemasonry, Kabbalah, Muslim Brotherhood, they all come out of that, you know, thing. And the idea was to guard the knowledge from the people. So before that, the people probably knew all about the lizards and all about everything, how to heal themselves, what plants, everything. And then they started hiding the knowledge under the guise of religion or, you know, spirituality or like a cult or whatever. And that's what they're into. And so it's interesting that you have this nexus in the City of London between the, you know, the money of the world, all derivatives trade from there, all offshore banking emanates from there. The banks vote. You can't be a city councilor or an alderman without being a freeman or a Freemason. And they all have that. They all have the Freemason Lodge. So there's a spiritual component to this, or at least a historical component, where they know something that they are guarding the secret of. And that's what it is. It's the bloodlines. It's the cross, which indicates the cross between the Nephilim bloodline, I believe, and the human bloodline. So the Red Cross, kind of this obsession with DNA, obsession with bloodlines, fact that the crown does have different blood, largely Rh negative blood, 85% of them. And very few other people have it. And the ones that do are in the Basque region of northern Spain, southern France, where the royals did come together in the 10th, 12th century, did a lot of intermarriage, and then kind of moved off to the British Isles and off in different directions. But did decide that the United Kingdom was going to be their place, where as a United Kingdom, you know, they would rule the world, because it had a rocky shoreline, like Venice. You know, it was hard. Venice was on the shipping lanes too when they first moved there from Rome, got kicked out, you know, by the Catholic Church. The Templars moved their stuff up there. And then from there, they had to have a seaport. But British Isles, even better, because it's very rocky and defendable against, you know, the hordes of humanity that might feel like you're ill-treating them, which they were. So they did develop it as the United Kingdom. That's what they meant by that. And but now, if you look at City of London, and if you look at the bloodlines, it's not a British thing. There's some British, there's some, you know, Scottish, Irish, there's a lot of Italians, there's a lot of Germans, a lot of French, really a lot of Italians, probably more than anything, that actually run, you know, actually are the bloodlines and run the city. But they're all dispersed all over the world too. Like I say, the King of Thailand is a part of this bloodlines. Kings and queens everywhere. And that's why the simple thing to do is, you know, we have to have some kind of global movement to get rid of monarchy. You know, we don't have that problem in America. We do have it covertly because, you know, they run the Federal Reserve. They run Congress now, with all the contracting. They're increasingly controlling everything. So we need to get them off our back. But how can we do that if they're still heads of state in these countries? So that these countries that have monarchies need to get rid of them. It's just such an antiquated, stupid, come on, man, it's the 21st century, you know? So nobody gets to get born into the world with a special bloodline and get a free ride just because of that. It's just not how we are. We're a meritocracy.
It's crazy. And, you know, I think people are dismissive, or they roll their eyes when you hear, like, you know, bloodline families or blue bloods, these things. It's like, but there is history about this. This isn't just us, you know, speculating and making this up. What makes it even more obvious that this is true is that it matters to them. It might not matter to us. We might roll our eyes at the idea of bloodlines, but watching their reaction to it, their overcompensation, they're very protective of this. They act in a way as if this is the most important thing in the world. And maybe they know something we don't know. I mean, as a course of standard operating procedure, they tend to hide things from us that they don't want us to know. So I don't know why this would be any different. So my point is, it's easy to be dismissive of concepts like bloodline families because it sounds stupid to us, but their oversized reaction to it makes me think that there is a whole lot more to it than we might be, you know. And to be fair, they could set it up in a way that, of course, it sounds preposterous, you know, like, oh, you blue bloods and royal bloodline families. Oh, what's coming next, David Icke's reptilians? And it's like, maybe, you know, perhaps there's something more to this. The Rh negative component of the blood, and the history of, you know, people that have that having red hair and some sort of thing. It's like, I'm not a historian. I don't know the ins and outs of this, but there are far too many people talking about very specific items with regard to blood and bloodlines, Rh negative, things like that, that make me think that there's more to this story than what the casual observer might think. Is there a whole lot more to this?
I mean, I think there is. And again, you're so right that it doesn't really matter, you know, what we think, if it's weird, if it's true. It doesn't really matter, does it? Because to them, you know, they obviously, I mean, when you talk about the Holy Grail, you know, you're talking about, you know, the Sangreal, you're talking about the royal blood, you know, and all these myths going way back. And they are obsessed with it. Obviously, that's, I mean, we didn't even know, like, DNA. We never talked about DNA in this world until, what, 20 years ago, maybe? And all of a sudden, DNA everywhere, you know? And it started with the genomics, the Human Genome Project, which was, again, a Rockefeller-funded thing. And this actually, if you look back, this may have been the first sort of foray into the Fourth Industrial Revolution, because you have to be able to identify the DNA of the people. Two reasons. One, if you're controlling the planet, and you are, and it is by bloodline, and your blood is blue or royal or Sangreal or whatever you say it is, you know, it's up to you. You're related to Jesus, I hear, and everything else. So if that's true, then these people would want to identify other people in the population who have that blood. Because me or you think that would be, you know, why would you do that? Well, because they're fascists. This ideology, this obsession with bloodline, it pretty much by default, they become fascists. And they believe everything is sort of, you know, automaton physiology, you know, dependent on your parents, you know, whatever, and all this stuff, and which is nonsense if you ask me, but that's what they believe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they're doing it for two reasons. They're obsessed with it to try to weed out, you know, who they think will be akin to them because they have the blood, and maybe they'll be better, you know, middle managers or, you know, some sort of toady in the pyramid structure. Right. And then also, it's going to be a huge moneymaker because that's what the Fourth Industrial Revolution is all about. So increasingly, you're going to see this obsession with bloodlines, which kind of goes hand in hand with the sort of the uncovering of the veil off of the, I can't call it anything, but like a Luciferian cult, which is emerging through the COVID crisis, you know, like the vaccine is like the sacrament, you know, that we're all have to take the sacrament, you know, and if you don't wear a mask, you're a sinner. And, you know, if you don't social distance, you're a sinner. And, you know, if you go into the Capitol building, I'm so much better than you. I'm so much more superior than you. And I feel good about that. And it's just this bizarre time where there's all this virtue signaling about nothing. And then if you look at what actually happens, and so it's part of the initiation into the Luciferian cult. And I think the internet has really sadly accelerated that, along with television. I mean, you can't underestimate the role of television. It's still huge. But now being interactive, that people can actually think that they're using their own brain to go somewhere, search for something. But in fact, they're being fed lies by Google. You know, try to type my name in on Google and see what happens.
Yeah.
I used to be at the top of the heap, you know, for 5-6 years in a row. And this is what's happened. You know, all my YouTubes are deleted. This may last a week. If you do YouTube, Charlie, hope you have other platforms. I don't know what they are. I'm sort of becoming more of a Luddite and getting away from computers, realizing that it was really the trap. It was the spider's web.
The Unabomber was right.
Unabomber probably was right. You know, let's face it. And I was in Montana when they got him. And my sister's like, God, I'm glad that wasn't you, man. I thought it was going to be
anyway. I feel like, you know, you do a lot of great work on oil, of course, as part of this. I mean, you're in a variety of topics, but oil and the mining, the drilling, the collection of oil. And it seems like these days it's the new oil is data, and that is the same sort of methods that they're using for extracting and corralling all of the oil is the same sort of methods that they're using for extracting and corralling all the data. You start to see some of the same groups involved. I get very nervous when I see the Black Rocks and Blackstones of the world coming in and buying things like Ancestry. I'm very nervous when I know the relationship of 23andMe to Google and the Wojcicki's being involved in running of that. So as we move into this new world order, or this, you know, build back better fourth industrial revolution. Maybe oil is on the way out, but data is replacing it as the most valuable in commodity around.
Yeah, that's it. And I think we're going to be turned, you know, the goal of their project is literally to turn us into batteries, and that you won't need oil anymore. You won't need that sort of energy anymore. What you're going to depend on now is, yeah, literally mining Bitcoin, you know, and literally just wasting your time doing something on a computer that helps giant corporations make money and getting really virtually nothing for it, and thinking that you have freedom and thinking that this is really where it's at, and just this huge energy suck. So it's really a human, like Catherine Austin Fitz said, I think she said it the best I've heard, is it we're moving from an oil, a petroleum-based economy to a human-based economy. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going on. They're going to mine us now. I mean, they've mined the hell out of the earth and, you know, trees and minerals and oil and whatever. And now they're going to mine us as individuals and make distinctions between us, big ones, you know, because you have to compete. It's just capitalism, you know, and these opportunity zones are part of this that just have been recently coming out. And Allison McDowell is a really, I really like what she's saying. She's hitting the nail on the head. Yeah, she's really good and she's right. And that's what's so important, I think, for people to realize. Again, it's not some socialist takeover. This is a purely laissez-faire capitalist, bordering on feudalist thing. And when it does go open bloodline, that's when we'll go, you know, feudalism. And it could have to do with something in Jerusalem with the Third Temple. I don't know. It could have to do something with Prince William. I don't know. The fact that they did say they're, you know, Merovingians are related to Jesus, and he's got Merovingian blood because mm-hmm. King Juan Carlos has it. And King Juan Carlos, you know, kicked out of Spain. Pretty interesting. Got involved with the Mexican Railroad corruption scam. And he's in exile. He had to leave his own country. So the royals are on the ropes a little bit here. The bloodlines are on the ropes a little bit here. And that's the other thing that's going on with the COVID, or the acceleration of the COVID agenda, which is really lockstep. You can just call this lockstep. And now what they're waiting for, they've already got the lockdown, but what they're waiting for is that lockstep, you know, where everybody will march in single file to this shit. And it's not going to happen, obviously. Yeah. And so that makes them more freaked out and double down. And they'll, you know, that, like, for example, they'll never admit that they were wrong. That, look, which state had the biggest lockdown, most restrictions in the United States? Oh, that was California. Guess what? California is like a death camp of COVID right now, apparently. South Dakota, which, what do we do? We didn't lock anything down. We were one of three states that didn't. North Dakota and Tennessee were the others. And then North Dakota did actually do a mask mandate. In Tennessee, a lot of cities and whatever, but we didn't do it. And so we had a bad thing for a while. We got through it. I think we had 138 cases yesterday. People don't wear masks here. They're healthy. They exercise. Nobody's tripping. Nobody's like pointing fingers saying, you know, my side's better than your side because I wear a mask. Because I don't wear a mask, I could care. You know, go and wear a mask. Go ahead. But I'm not going to be the part of the cult. And anyway, they'll never admit that our numbers are crashing and things are getting better because we have herd immunity now. We let it run through the young people and the healthy people. I probably had it in September. My guess, my wife and I both think we probably had it. Do we go to the doctor? No, hell no. Do we? I mean, take vitamin C, eat good. Same as I would do with anything. And I'm not getting tested because the PCR test is part of the scam. It's part of the identification of your DNA prop. You know, it's a big part of the whole thing. So I'm never going to be tested. Forget it. And so that'll mean I can't fly, and that'll mean a lot of things. And then the vaccination. And then this is what we're coming up into now, Charlie, is just we're going to find out, like, what people like us will be able to do, you know, in this new society. And it really depends how many people resist, how many people refuse, you know, to take the vaccination is a big one. And so we're going to find out, but at least we're going to find out pretty soon. Right. And that's one good thing about it. Yeah. But it's all a scam. It's all part of the agenda. Everything they do is for an agenda. And this is definitely for the fourth industrial revolution agenda, the global reset agenda, that this COVID was, you know, this fake COVID thing was put out there. And, so yeah, and it will accelerate it, and that it, they had to go there pretty fast too, because the banks in September of last year, we were hearing that the repo windows, the banks, you know, they were opening the repo window with the Fed, and that the interbank lending rate was like 10-15%, and you know, Deutsche Bank was on ropes, and J.P. Morgan Chase was on ropes, and so they had to do some sort of shock. And I do think if that hadn't happened, I mean, if COVID hadn't conveniently come along, in other words, the stock market would have probably crashed in March anyway, just like it did without COVID, you know, and then they were able to do a shock, and they were able to increase, you know, the move towards Zoom, you know, and the move towards Uber and the move towards DoorDash and, you know, all the stuff that they own and that comes along, telemedicine, teleeducation, all the things they control. And that's why, of course, the market's going up now, because the corporations are loving this. And it looks like, you know, at least for a while, they're going to be able to make money on this thing. How long they'll make money on this, that's the whole thing. This is one giant experiment. So if it fails, which we hope it does, then things are going to crash out bad. Yeah. And that still could happen, because I think these people are not thinking straight either on a lot of things. And they somehow seem to think that without, that they can have this big economy, this economy, this new fourth industrial without consumers, you know, and that's not going to be true. So how are we going to get consumers? And is it going to be a universal basic income? And then if we have the universal basic income, I mean, what happens to the national debt, which is $27 trillion? How do we pay for that? You know, how are you going to get around that? Where are you going to get any kind of production from the humans? What are the humans going to do? They're just going to sit around and you know, so it's not a sure thing. It's not a slam dunk. Let's just say that. And you could easily see this whole thing come off the rails, and the 5G not work out, and the vaccination kill people, and the satellites fall from the sky, and you could easily see that still. And that's probably our best hope, because the humans, a lot of them disappoint, you know, not all of them, but a lot of them are inspiring too. But, you know, I'm just saying, it's disappointing to see who's folding immediately.
Yeah, there's a lot of people outing themselves, you know, showing who they really are. I'll tell you what, there's nobody I would rather share a FEMA cell with than Dean Henderson. You can check out his books on Amazon, Big Oil and Their Bankers in the Persian Gulf, Nephilim, Crown 5G Apocalypse, and Illuminati Agenda 21. Dean, you're the best. Thank you so much for coming on and explaining some very complicated things in a simple way that makes sense to everybody. I appreciate it, and thank you so much. And everybody listening, if you like this show, if you thought this was great, share it with your friends and family. It's the only way this is going to happen. Thanks, everybody.
In honor of Military Appreciation Month, Verizon thought of a lot of different ways we could show our appreciation, like rolling out the red carpet, giving you your own personal marching band, or throwing a bumping shindig. At Verizon, we're doing all that in the form of special military offers. That's why, this month only, we're giving military and veteran families a $200 Verizon gift card and a phone on us, with a select trade-in and a new line on select unlimited plans. Think of it as our way of flying a squadron of jets overhead while launching fireworks. Now that's what we call a celebration, because we're proud to serve you. Visit your local Verizon store to learn more. $200 Verizon gift card requires smartphone purchase, $799.99 or more with new line on eligible plan. Gift card sent within 8 weeks after receipt of claim. Phone offer requires $799.99 purchase with new smartphone line on Unlimited Ultimate or postpaid Unlimited Plus. Minimum plan $80 a month with autopay plus taxes and fees for 36 months. Less $800 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. 0% APR. Trade-in must be from Apple, Google, or Samsung. Trade-in and additional terms apply. In honor of Military Appreciation Month, Verizon thought of a lot of different ways we could show our appreciation, like rolling out the red carpet, giving you your own personal marching band, or throwing a bumping shindig. At Verizon, we're doing all that in the form of special military offers. That's why, this month only, we're giving military and veteran families a $200 Verizon gift card and a phone on us, with a select trade-in and a new line on select unlimited plans. Think of it as our way of flying a squadron of jets overhead while launching fireworks. Now that's what we call a celebration, because we're proud to serve you. Visit your local Verizon store to learn more. $200 Verizon gift card requires smartphone purchase, $799.99 or more with new line on eligible plan. Gift card sent within 8 weeks after receipt of claim. Phone offer requires $799.99 purchase with new smartphone line on Unlimited Ultimate or postpaid Unlimited Plus. Minimum plan $80 a month with autopay plus taxes and fees for 36 months. Less $800 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. 0% APR. Trade-in must be from Apple, Google, or Samsung. Trade-in and additional terms apply.